Members, I'm going to call a May 10th, 2021 meeting of the Taxes Conference Committee on House File 991 to order under Remote Rules 10.01 of the House. And welcome, everyone. And with that, I'm going to ask Mr. Peterson to please take the roll.
Chair Marquardt.
Marquardt, present.
Marquardt, present. Representative Davids.
Davids, present.
Davids, present. Representative Herr.
Present.
Herr, present. Representative Lislegaard.
Present.
Lislegaard, present. Representative Joachim.
Present.
Joachim, present. Chair Nelson.
Present.
Nelson, present. Senator Bach.
Here.
Bach, present. Senator Miller.
Here.
Miller, present. Senator Rust.
Present.
Rust, present. Senator Weber?
Present.
Weber, present. 10 members present with a quorum, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Peterson. We do have a quorum. Before we start with the agenda, as many of you know, probably a little over an hour ago, the U.S. Department of Treasury issued its interim final rule on how funding can be spent on the American Rescue Plan Act. And I mean, the important part for us, of course, is, you know, can conformity and tax cuts and that, can we use federal funding for that? And if you want to look at kind of the pertinent parts, it starts about page 81 of the interim final rules. And it looks, and it's early yet, but, you know, as far as kind of the clawback on funding from the feds, it sounds like that would not impact that. Any conformity or that would, you know, trigger the fact that there'd be a clawback of funds. But it's not clear yet, and we've got kind of folks looking at it so forth, is it a permissible use of these federal fundings to use it for conformity, tax conformity, and so forth. So I think we just need to look at this a little closer. It just isn't clear from kind of staff looking at it. If you try to read it, it's really tough to understand. So anyway, hopefully within a day, we'll know a lot more information, because that certainly is a very important component of everything we're going to be doing here. So anyway, just on that. Second, appreciate folks here, and the agenda we're going to cover are some more items today on low or no cost items. I know at least one is in both the House and the Senate bill. And as Chair Nelson has said repeatedly, you know, we hope we can get this global agreement done. And, you know, it could come today, it could come tomorrow, or, you know, in 2 weeks. But at any rate, I think it's important that if we do get targets, that would kind of consume pretty much everything we would do from that point on, is all kind of the big spending items. So it's important at this point, I think, and I've talked to Chair Nelson, you know, if we can, you know, kind of cover the more things we can adopt, and believe it or not, we have adopted 6 articles already, which I think is really good. But the more we can adopt and the more of these smaller, low or no cost items that we can at least debate and so forth, the better we're going to be. And also, I think less is the chance that we will lose these somewhere along the route. And it kind of lays the foundation of things. So even if we happen not to get global agreements by May 17th, which I'm hoping and confident we will, but we know that the later that is, or if we were to go into special session and there would be an agreement, the leadership isn't going to negotiate these smaller items. It's going to be the bigger items. And also at that point, things tend to happen very quickly. And so I'm thinking the more we can talk about these items in public, the better it's going to be. Because once you kind of get into the special session, or let's say And I want to be talking about special session because I anticipate that. I'm hoping we get things done yet. But even with a global agreement, things will happen quickly before May 17th. And I want to make sure that these things like local option sales tax and TIF and those things don't get lost. And so I think the more we can cover, the better it will be, and it'll make for a more transparent system. So, Chair Nelson, anything you want to add to that before I go to Representative Davids? Any kind of introductory comments you would kind of like to make today? And
yes, I think, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I agree with your introductory comments as well, and I'm glad for the most recent ruling regarding the use of those, that most recent tranche of federal funding, those ARPA funds. And it does appear that each successive ruling moves a little bit closer to allowing states to use those dollars for some sort of tax element, whether it be conformity seems to be the top of the list here. And the one thing that I would just add is there's always a good deal of conformity that's needed in Minnesota. And because we're a static conformity state, not a rolling conformity state, we have to if it's reducing taxes to the state of Minnesota, we have to have the resources to pay for that, for those tax reductions. And I would say that the need for conformity has just been on steroids since the pandemic. And we know that federal dollars, maybe up to $5 billion. We know we have $2.8 billion that were just released here with the ARPA funding, and then the previous funding before that, and there well could be more. But the point is, with so much federal influx during a time as we're coming out of a pandemic, it has been significant, that is for sure. It does really ratchet up the need for conformity, though. And so while it's always been a great need, it's even a greater need now, and that the federal government is not taxing those lifelines that have been given out through those federal funds. And we shouldn't be taxing them either in the state of Minnesota. But I would just say I appreciate your comments, Chair, on the need for conformity and the fact that we think we're getting closer to hopefully being able to use some of those federal funds for that. But until then, it is a little bit, members, of a kind of a wait and see, as we do hope that our leaders do come to that global target soon. And that will be of great help to us as we go forward. And so, Mr. Chair, I appreciate your comments. I look forward to the information today. And we will, I think we all believe that May 17th is our constitutionally required deadline. Actually, that's what the Constitution says. But if it's simply the deadline for those global budget targets, then we're going to need to be back again. But I'm hoping that our three leaders are able to spend the amount of time needed to get to agreement here early so we can do our work, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much.
Thank you for those comments, Madam Chair. You know, what is it, 7 days away? It's 7 days yet till May 17th. And, you know, 1 week is a long, long time in legislative time. So we can still do a lot of work, and I'm hoping we can get those targets here in the next day or two and get our work done. Representative Davids.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate your comments and Chair Nelson's comments. But this is the last guidance on in regard to doing conformity. This is the last guidance. So I think it's very clear. We can use those funds for conformity, and I really hope this conference committee is thinking about not just PPP or limits on PPP or unemployment, but it has to be full conformity, because this is something that's very, very important, and we know where we're at now. I'm not sure what any confusion is. I hope the department has this figured out. It's pretty clear to me. I mean, I can even figure this one out, that we need to move forward with this if we have any chance of getting done at the constitutionally time that we have to be done. We have to get on this, and I think we need to do what we're doing today, and, you know, we've adopted some things, as you said, but we know where we're at now. And we need to move this forward. We need to get going on this. And I hope we can do this as soon as possible, and that every member of the conference will fully support full conformity. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I concur in part with Representative Davids. I think we have to be very strategic about where we conform. The Senate is going to have its priorities, as Chair Nelson has indicated. We have never, that I can ever remember, fully conformed on every single thing that the federal government has chosen to pass, precisely for the reason that Minnesota sets its own course with regard to tax policy. But I am interested, with your indulgence, if Commissioner Doty, who's on the, in the committee this afternoon, if he has a couple of remarks about it, and if he sees some sort of general move forward, independent of what choices we actually make, if you don't mind, I'd like to hear from him.
You bet. Before I call on Commissioner Doty, I do want to remind everyone that this interim final rule like came out an hour or two ago. So, and I was trying to look through it, and it's cumbersome. Let me put it that way. But Commissioner Doty, what are maybe some thoughts that you might have, and welcome to the committee, on your look through this final rule.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Chair Nelson as well, and committee. So I will say, you know, we just got this like within the last hour as well. And so we are still trying to absorb it and look through it. MMB is looking through it in detail. There is a summary version of the Treasury guidelines, and then there is a 150-page document that I know MMB is looking at. So we're trying to make sure that we are seeing this correctly and moving forward. With having said that, I will say that conformity is, I completely agree with Representative Davids, how important conformity truly is. And I think that as we start to look at where we can conform, I think there's a lot of items that would be considered in full conformity. I mean, there are four or now five separate federal legislative acts that have occurred since we last conformed. And I mean, and quite frankly, there's more than 100 different proposals that are part of that. I think one of the things that we will need to look at is, items that are temporary or one-time items versus permanent items. And that should have a bearing on potentially how we would look at use of those, assuming that we can use these ARPA dollars in that way. That would be something we would have to consider very closely. But I do think there are some potentially great opportunities, and this might be a potentially once in a lifetime thing for us as we start to look at this closely. But there are some very important items that we've decoupled or considering decoupling because we did not assume we might have this. So I agree. There's some things there for us to look at.
Well, thank you very much, Commissioner. And I think, by tomorrow, I think things will be a lot more clear with MMB and Department of Revenue folks getting a good look at this. And so that will be good to see what the thoughts are, kind of the conclusion is on that. So, well, thank you very much. I think we'll get going with the agenda. So we do have five items on the agenda that are no or low cost items, some more things we can talk about that we can kind of lay a foundation, and at least when we need to move quickly, we've talked about these things out in the public and so forth. So with that, the first one, number one, is homestead deadline moved to December 31st, and a bill in both the House and the Senate. Mr. Swanson, I'm going to call on you to go over that, and then we'll take any members' questions and so forth. So, Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Chair and members, as we get started, I'll just note that we will be working off of a document that's titled Conference Committee 5-10-21. So that's a table similar to what we've used over the past week that gives a little bit of information about each provision and notes its location in the side-by-side as well as both the House and Senate bill where applicable. So starting with the first provision, this moves back the deadlines for the homestead application and the disabled veterans market value exclusion. This is on page 27 and 28 of the side-by-side and can be found in Article 7, Sections 8, 9, and 17 of the House bill, and Article 4, Sections 3, 4, and 9 of the Senate bill. Working off of the House version, Section 8 changes the homestead occupancy and application deadline. So under current law, property must be used as a homestead by December 1st, and an application must be submitted by December 15th in order for a property owner to receive homestead status for the following taxes payable year. This section would move both of those dates back to December 31st. Section 9 of Article 7 in the House bill contains one conforming change related to the changes in Section 8. Again, this is just stating that the homestead application deadline would move from December 15th to December 31st. I'll also note that this section in the House bill contains one additional provision related to the ITIN changes in the property tax article, and it's because of this that the side-by-side notes are similar for this section, but the homestead application deadline changes are the same in both the House and the Senate bills. Finally, Section 17 moves the application deadline for the disabled veterans market value exclusion from December 15th to December 31st. And these three sections were all found in House File 195, which was carried by Representative Detmer in the House.
Thank you. Mr. Swanson, would you cover what is the title of this? It should have been attached to the meeting invite, and it's posted on the House website. What is the title that we're looking at right now?
Mr. Chair and members, the document title is Conference Committee 5-10-21. So it's just a PDF that's titled Conference Committee, and it has today's date on it. It is on the website and was included in the last round of materials that Mr. Justin sent out.
Okay. Oh, there it is. Conference Committee. All right. Conference Committee 5-10-21 PDF. It's towards the bottom of the attachments, about the third one up. All right. Very good. Just to get everyone there in the public. Thank you. Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to clarify that the provision about changing the date is identical in both bills. It's only the addition of the I-10 that makes the makes the Senate provisions different from the House. So we don't have anything to do, not anything to do. We don't mention I-10 anywhere with regard to homestead applications, but our language is the same with regard to the disabled veterans and also just the general moving of that date with regard to them. Is that correct? And I would ask that from your counsel's affirmation that that's the difference, I-10 or no I-10.
Yeah, Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Rest, that's correct. So the Section 8 in the House bill and Section 3 of Article 4 in the Senate bill are identical. The disabled veterans sections, which are Article 7, Section 17 in the House bill, and Article 4, Section 9 in the Senate bill, that is also identical. The only difference is in Section 8 of the House bill and Section 4 of the Senate bill. And again, that is that ITIN provision is included in that section within the House bill.
I see.
It is not included in the Senate bill, and that's the only difference.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you know, that is a significant policy change that individually we may have different opinions on, but it's not in the Senate bill.
Correct. Any other questions or comments on this first agenda item? All right, thank you. Let's move to the second one, Tourism Improvement District, and that is Mr. Clayman.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to go through the Tourism Improvement District provisions. This would be on page 45 and 46 of the side-by-side, or Article 13, Sections 13 through 22 in the House bill. And the underlying bill is House File 1066. That was a bill from Representative D'Avney in the House. So the Tourism Improvement District provisions, what they would do is create a new chapter of law allowing for Tourism Improvement Districts. And what those are, those would be geographically defined areas of a municipality in which a group of lodging businesses pay a service charge to fund tourism and other business promotion and potentially economic development activities in the district as authorized by a local ordinance. And a district can only be established upon a petition by a majority of the business owners who would be subject to the service charge. And these, if I didn't state it already, these are just lodging businesses that this would apply to. So. And then upon a petition from these businesses and following a number of prescribed notice and hearing requirements, a city, county, or a town can create an ordinance to establish a tourism improvement district. And they have to specify in that ordinance what the district boundaries are and create a tourism improvement association, which I'll talk about in a minute, define the activities to fund, the manner in which and the amount of the charges and so forth. A district would be administered and funds would be managed by a tourism improvement association. That would be, again, established by the ordinance, and a majority of the board members of a tourism improvement association would have to be businesses who are subject to the service charges in the district. The association would also be responsible for meeting all the objectives of the district as established by the ordinances. And a tourism improvement association must also file an annual report every year describing its activities and its funding, et cetera. The service charges would be imposed on lodging businesses based on their benefits received from the activities funded. There's a variety of ways that the provisions would allow these service charges to be imposed, for instance, gross revenue or a per transaction charge or other methods that may be allowed by ordinance. And then every year, a hearing must be held on the continuation of the service charges. Service charges must be collected by the municipality, the Tourism Improvement Association, or another designee established in ordinance. Business owners also have the right to appeal, veto, or disestablish a district. So for appeals, those would have to be made to the district 45 days of the ordinance. For vetoes, within 5 days of passing an ordinance, a veto letter has to be sent to businesses who would be subject to the fee. And by a majority, the filing of a majority of business owners' objections, they could then veto the district. As for disestablishment, there would be a required 30-day annual period for disestablishment in which a majority of the businesses could petition for disestablishment. The municipality then, if they received that petition from a majority of the affected businesses, could then disestablish that district by ordinance. And then finally, Mr. Chair, these districts could be established by counties, cities, and towns. So where there might be overlap, the bill actually prohibits county and then the city town tourism improvement districts from overlapping. And so that's a summary of the tourism improvement district provisions.
Thank you, Mr. Klayman. So this was a bill introduced by Representative Dabney, but was carried in the property tax division report. So I'd like to ask Chair Joaquim for your comments on this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Klayman, for going over the bill at the high level with the language. Really appreciate it. Tourism district, I should also mention that Senator Dietzick carried this bill in the Senate. Tourism and hospitality industry was really the first hit during the pandemic and will likely be the last to fully recover. The recovery of the tourism and hospitality industry in Minnesota is very important to the recovery of our whole state's economy, and this proposal will provide the industry with kind of a tool, a source of funds for needed recovery without any fiscal impact on the state. In the February forecast, just to show you some numbers, MMB reported Minnesota's leisure and hospitality sector lost 123,400 jobs, 44% of the sector's employment between February and December of 2020. We're talking about lack of meetings and conventions and festivals, tournaments, sporting events, et cetera, and other key events that are drivers for the tourism economy and hotel stays. During the pandemic, hotel occupancy in Minnesota hit a historic low. Hotel revenue was down 48.5% statewide January 2021 compared to January 2020. In the metropolitan area, hotel revenue was down as much as 82.7% in Minneapolis and 66.3% in Bloomington. Tourism improvement districts are modeled after existing law, authorizing the establishment of special service districts. The difference is a tourism improvement district is not based on a property tax assessment, but is a service charge on the lodging night. Like I said, it was put forward by Representative Dabney in the House, Senator Dietzick in the Senate. A tourism improvement district would be established through a partnership among the private businesses, local government, either city or county, and tourism promotion and organizations. It is a public-private partnership to provide supplemental funding for specific tourism activities. And as Mr. Klayman said, it's through a local ordinance process the district's established, and that they set the service charge on the lodging night within the designated geographic boundaries. The funds generated may only be used for new tourism-specific activities that must benefit these lodging businesses. The legislation grants this statewide authority, but it does no city or county will be required to establish a tourism improvement district. And I think that's about all I needed to cover, but I want to be able to be available for questions as well. It has a lot of supporters from the Minnesota Association of Convention and Visitors Bureaus, Minnesota Arrowhead Tourism Association, City of Duluth, Greater Minneapolis Hotel Association, and there's a longer list here. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Chair Joaquim. Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to speak up, even though it's not in the Senate bill, speak up in favor of this. I think we need to remember that tourism is 10, 11, 12% of all private sector jobs, which means it's very important in Minnesota. And I think if we had this, that it would be it would really help the tourism industry market Minnesota, and we have such great assets here going forward out of the pandemic. So I hope we give serious consideration to it, even though it's not in the in the Senate bill. And I appreciate Representative Joaquim's comments, and just keeping in mind that it doesn't supplant anything. It just supplements it. So I hope that you'll be very enthusiastic in speaking with our conferees about this. And I think there's 18, 20 other states that have something similar going, and we shouldn't get behind would be my 2 cents there. And I hope we seriously consider it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Chair Nelson. Chair Nelson, you're muted.
I see that. All right. Thank you so much. Well, I appreciate the opportunity to further delve into this. I do want to note that there are some questions which maybe we'll get to in this committee, but you know, we did not hear this in the Senate for the very reason that, well, you all mentioned that how difficult this pandemic and the shutdowns have been on our hospitality industry, lodging particularly. It's been devastating. And I agree, it may take some time for those lodging enterprises to come back. We do hope that tourism will return. We know we have a fabulous state in natural resources, its people, its arts. We have a phenomenal state for people to want to tour. Now, maybe our climate is a little challenging at some times, and I understand that, and we all do, but we all still choose to live here because it is a wonderful state. But what I would say is that when I read that there is that this bill intends to add an additional fee onto our lodging entities, that does concern me somewhat. An additional fee at a time when they're struggling so greatly does cause me great pause. And I will be interested to see the full list of who is supporting this. I understand the convention bureaus would choose to support this. I just don't know how our hoteliers feel, those who would be bearing the brunt of having an additional a surcharge or service charge on their services. So it'd be good to, if you could perhaps, Chair Joachim, if you could distribute or pass out that list of really who are all the supporters of this legislation, that would be very helpful, I think, as well. And we know that a transaction charge or any type of a charge is either paid by the business itself, or it is transferred to the consumers or the customers who would use that. And so, you know, would this make, and I understand it's voluntary, and so that's a plus, but I also would want to know how would this impact the recovery? I'm not sure that it would impact the recovery in a significant way. I will certainly delve into it more as I get the information from Chair Joachim, but the Senate did not look at this for the very reason of the devastating impacts of the COVID-related shutdowns and what that has done to the hospitality industry, particularly the lodging industry. So I'll look for that. And then also, one of my other questions has to do with, well, we do have a lodging tax. And my question is, what is the interplay between this special district a lodging assessment and the lodging tax? And would it be a requirement to have a lodging tax to then go one step further and have the special district service charge as well? I don't know. I think those are some good questions that you may already have some answers to. And so I do think there are some questions here that still remain, but it is good to know that we all agree how devastating the shutdowns and maybe other things as well, but the shutdowns particularly have been statewide on our lodging industry. It has been, and also we don't know how there are things that have transpired during this COVID pandemic where people are working remotely. More people are working remotely. Will they come back to those offices? Will they come back to those will they come back to those conventions? So I think it is an area that we really do need to look at and make sure that we do no harm. First rule, do no harm. And then secondly, can this be a benefit? And those are things that I think I'm not totally convinced yet that it would be a benefit. And perhaps some of the information that you share could help further as we look at that. But also the other big question is the uses. What would, under this particular piece of legislation, what would the authorized uses be? And how are those different than the authorized uses with the lodging tax? So those are things that I'd still like to see fleshed out. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much. Before I go to Chair Joachim, I'm wondering if Mr. Klayman or Ms. Hagler could answer that question on to kind of how do the lodging taxes and the tourism districts and the uses for the funds, how do they, how are they separate? How do they overlap? If someone could answer that. Mr. Klayman?
Sure, Mr. Chair. I can take a stab at that. Ms. Hagler might have further comments to make. There are some differences and similarities between the proposed tourism improvement district and the local lodging sales taxes. The local lodging sales taxes, they're imposed at a rate of 3%, and that would be on a citywide basis. And so you've got a different geographical area with the TIDs, because the TIDs could be a smaller geographical area than the city or the county or town, presumably. The local lodging sales taxes, they fund citywide tourism bureaus, and they could be used to market or promote the municipality as a tourism or convention center destination. So I think there's some overlap there. The local lodging sales tax also applies to lodging businesses, but specifically imposed on the transaction. So on the furnishing of lodging services. So as opposed to the more flexible approach under the TID, where you could have, there's a lot more flexibility in terms of how that fee is imposed. The local lodging sales taxes, they can be established by ordinance, whereas, which is of course the same in the TIDs, but, and Ms. Hagler may know for sure, but I don't think that the local lodging taxes require a petition. So TIDs would require a petition. The local lodging taxes can be collected by the commissioner of revenue along with the sales tax, which is not the case for the TIDs. And then the local lodging sales tax is not quite as targeted or does not allow for the kind of targeting that a TID could target. I think also potentially the tourism improvement districts could fund a broader range of activities than local lodging taxes. So in addition to promotion of other business activity, for instance, that's in the bill, of those businesses that are subject to the charge, marketing, sales, economic development, other services that, again, here's more of the flexibility piece of this, other services that could benefit those service charge paying businesses. So there's, again, there's a lot of leeway in terms of what the TID can be used for versus, again, just on a, my own superficial reading of the local lodging tax law and what you could do for a local lodging sales tax. So, Mr. Chair, those are the comments I have on that issue of where the overlap is. And again, I don't know if Ms. Hagler has anything else to say about that. But
well, thank you very much. I'm going to call on Ms. Hagler. Anything that you want to add to that question on lodging tax versus the tourism districts?
Mr. Chair and members, Mr. Klayman did a really good job explaining the local lodging tax and how it these can originate locally without the legislature approving them unless they need some sort of special exception. And the majority of the funds, 95% of the funds, have to go to the promotion of tourism within the city. And so as far as I can tell, there really isn't an interplay here. There isn't a you can have one and not the other, or they're not mutually exclusive. So there can be both, and it really shouldn't affect how the local lodging tax is administered or anything like that.
All right. Thank you very much. Chair Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just as Senator Rest pointed out, this is to supplement, not supplant. So Ms. Hagler and Mr. Klayman explained that really well. And that a reminder, too, this is just another tool in the toolbox. This has to come from the hotels. they have to petition to have this tool put in place, and they have to have an agreement among each other, and they're the ones that structure it. So this is would have to come from the hotels to ask for this. I just think we owe it to this industry to give them all the tools in the toolbox that they need to help come back from COVID. And this is one that does not cost the state anything and is also has to be organic. It has to come from the hotel industry themselves. So just wanted to put that out there.
Very good. Thank you. Anyone else on the tourism improvement districts? All right. Good discussion. Thank you, Mr. Clayman, Ms. Hagler, for explaining those things also. Very good. We're going to move to number three, the state taconite aid and iron ore bearing material, and this is something that was in the governor's tax bill. Mr. Swanson.
Mr. Chair and members, the provisions related to the iron ore bearing material can be found on page 26 of the side-by-side, and these three sections are in the special taxes article of the House tax bill, and that's Article 6, Sections 4, 5, and 6. And these three sections modify the definition of other iron-bearing material so that lump ore is now included in this definition and as a result would be subject to the production tax. Under current law, mining that does not result in a product that produces taconite pellets is not subject to the production tax. But it's my understanding, Mr. Chair, that there is now a new scram mining operation that produces lump ore instead of these pellets. This change would just subject the products of that process to the production tax.
Thank you very much. I'm going to call on Representative Lestigard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, Mr. Swanson did a nice job, and I'm sure Senator Bach can follow up too. But this is a new product that typically is being shipped in throughout the great from out of the seas to the Great Lakes to supply to blast furnaces and other facilities. So this is a good thing for Northeast Minnesota, and it is a product that we hope that takes off and it will bring an added value to Northeast Minnesota and the state.
Thank you, Senator Bach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This project is on the west side of the Iron Range. It's a new mining project, a new technology. I believe the uptake agreement is with a company in Canada. That's where the lump ore will actually be shipped. So it's not going to displace any production that the range currently has where we send pellets, largely to the lower Great Lakes. I believe they're pretty close to having all of their environmental permits. They probably will get started by the end of the year. I don't believe it's going to generate the kind of tonnage that is in the revenue estimate from the department. But I should say, Mr. Chairman, there's a you need to remember mining companies don't pay corporate income taxes. They pay a production tax and an occupation tax. Back in, and I don't want to go back too far, but I guess back in 2001, I believe, when we actually starting back in the 90s, when we started to do rate compression on business, corporate business property taxes, at one time, the class rate on CI was, Senator Reskin, correct me if I'm wrong, I think about 5.6. We were started compressing that down. And the last time we made a major move on it was in 2001 when we actually took the CI class rate down to 2%. In the process of all that rate compression and all that business tax relief, the mines did not get anything because they didn't pay property taxes. So in the 2001, the big tax bill that had significant changes in our tax system, including property taxes, taking the excess operating levy off of business property, there was a decision made to help the mining companies. So I thought it was 21 cents, but it looks like in the fiscal note, it's a revenue estimate, it's 22 cents. The state actually pays general fund money to the IRRB who then passes actually a larger amount than what we receive from the state through to the companies every year to reinvest in equipment and do maintenance on the mining properties. So in a sense, they didn't get cash tax relief like other businesses did. They got tax relief in the form of a tax rebate that they then had to invest in property and maintenance on the mines. So we actually pay out, depending on tonnage, for anywhere around $8 to $12 or $13 million a year out to the mining companies through the IRRB. Some of that is state general fund money that comes to us. And so this does show a cost, and that's why, because for the tonnage they send off, they're going to get that same kind of a credit that the other mining companies get per ton. I just would suggest, Mr. Chairman, if you find yourself in a position where we just don't have the money for the credit, this can be, I think, constructed so that it doesn't have a general fund cost. This is a brand new facility. They don't have the kind of needs with, you know, outdated equipment and equipment that needs maintenance because it's an all new project. We probably could delay for a couple years their access to, it's called the Taconite Economic Development Fund, it's the rebate money. We probably could delay that a couple years. They wouldn't like that because they'd certainly like to get it like everybody else, but they would have a little harder argument, I think, that they need money for maintenance than the older mining companies are. So, Mr. Chairman, if you feel you can't fit it in because of the cost, let me suggest let's find a way to maybe delay their rebate for a couple years. But getting them on the tax rolls is pretty important. So we do need this change to make sure that the ore that they send out of Minnesota actually is taxed by Minnesota. So that's my story.
Thank you, Senator Bach. Appreciate that. Any thoughts or comments on this further? Usually, I remember when Ann Lincheski was chair of the tax committee, anything to do with taconite or that, she would just give to the range legislators and say, work it out, bring it back to the tax committee, and we'll give it the stamp of approval. That's usually what happens. And it sounds like we're hearing a support there, an agreement among our range delegation that we have here on the conference committee. So that's good.
I'm not aware of any opposition, Mr. Chairman. You might want to check with Representative Lizegard and have him drop it around the House range members, but I'm not aware of any in the Senate.
Very good. Thank you much. We're going to move to number four on the agenda, the free file report, and I'm going to call on Mr. Williams.
Chair Mark Warden, members, we're talking about the free filing report provision that's on page 47 of your side-by-side. It's in Article 13, Section 27 of the House bill. It originated in a House bill, House File 376, which was authored by Representative Joaquin, and I understand that Senator Rest has a comparable provision in Senate File 488.
Mr. Williams, I'm going to interrupt you right now. I apologize, but Commissioner Doty wanted to say something on the last item. That's okay. So, Commissioner Doty, I'm going to move back to the state taconite iron ore bearing commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's not that big a deal. I just wanted to two things I think are important to note, and I think Senator Bach actually covered them. But one was that we have specifically reached out to this company to kind of, you know, share with them, you know, what was being proposed and to kind of, you know, make sure they understood, and there was no opposition from them. So Senator Bach is absolutely right. And I will say also that that I think that what was supposed to happen was this process and getting this the company and everything up and running was supposed to happen a little sooner. And the revenue estimate actually assumed that it would be sooner. There have been delays in this process. So that's why the revenue estimate is probably, as Senator Bach said, a little off. So in that regard. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. Mr. Williams.
So the free file report, it would be due by February 15 of next year. And it's essentially the Commissioner of Revenue would have to survey tax preparation software vendors to gain information about free electronic preparation and filing options for taxpayers. The report would have to include a review of options that other states use for state electronic filing, an assessment of taxpayer needs for electronic filing, an analysis of alternative options to provide free filing, such as tax credits, vendor incentives, or other benefits, and an analysis of the existing IRS free file program usage. And this provision has a $175,000 appropriation in the House bill. And I'll pause after each one if it's okay with you, Chair Mark.
That sounds good. So this is a bill that was authored by Representative Joachim, and even though not an actual companion, Senator Rest also has a bill, as Mr. Williams mentioned, very identical. So Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I really do think that that this is a very valuable thing for us to do for our taxpayers and for the filing of returns, that the more automatic they are, the more streamlined they are, the fewer mistakes when people have to currently enter information, even though they qualify for free filing at the federal level. And I think, in my own opinion, that the department needs to sharpen its pencil, Commissioner Doty. I don't think it should cost $175,000 to get this report done. And this is something I've worked on for 6 or 7 years now, and I appreciate Representative Joachim taking it on, and maybe we can get something done in this area at a much lower cost, but with the same benefit. So thank you very much for that, for doing that. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Weber.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt. I just have a question regarding this issue. Not that I'm against it or anything, but I went online and checked out what tax-free options are available. And there are a variety of companies that do provide a cost-free ability to file electronically your state of Minnesota tax return. Now, there's usually some income requirements. You know, you can't be above a certain level. I think the top one I saw was $70,000+, which, in my opinion, if you're making $70,000+, you can afford to pay a little something for your tax return being done. My question is, what are we hoping to gain by such a report? I guess I'm not totally clear on that.
So I'm going to turn that to Chair Joachim.
That question. First, I just want to thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to thank Senator Rest for all her work on this, too. It's been nice to be along for the ride with her and former Department of Revenue Assistant Commissioner Terry Steenblock, which this was one of her babies before she retired. But it's pretty simple. Not everyone qualifies for filing their taxes online for free. A lot of the times you have to buy a product to help you do that. And while some of the products out there say that they have their product for free, it usually isn't as interactive, or it's only partial product, and they end up charging the person. Bottom line is, we ask folks to pay their taxes. And I want to make this process a little simpler for them. Get the monetary resources needed out of the way for those filing their taxes, to be able to use something that's intuitive software program in a public-private partnership. We would not want the Department of Revenue creating and becoming a vendor. This is a way to look and see what those private-public partnerships could look like. And as Senator Rest said, filing taxes electronically not only is quicker and easier and leaves less room for error, it also is safer. When they can hook their state tax to their federal tax together, we have less of a chance of people being able to file false returns or people taking other people's information or data. So it's important. I think this is a very simple report, a simple bill that could make a lot of folks' lives a lot easier. Folks, we're asking them to pay these taxes. We should help them do it in the simplest way possible.
So, Senator Weber.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt. Maybe I have a question for the department. Those companies that offer that service now, filing for free with the state of Minnesota, and I know of two parties that each used a different company, and they had absolutely no charge. Is there some process by which the company goes through at this time in order to be able to provide that service to the public? I mean, that they go through with the department?
Commissioner Doty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Weber, there's no specific process in that regard. I think to Representative Joachim's point, to some degree, it's, and I hate to put it like this, some degree it's almost buyer beware to some degree, that there are, and I will leave them all nameless, but there are some private companies that advertise, that definitely advertise free options. But as Representative Joachim said, you have to buy something to get something. And so in effect, it's really not very free, if you will. One of the things that we have on our website is some true free options that are there. But Senator Weber, I cannot tell you how many times I've heard of complaints from customers who have started a process and realized that they have to pay something. So this is definitely an area where we could do a better job of helping taxpayers make sure that they do have the free option that is available. And by the way, also to your other point, it is, I think the income requirement, I believe, is 72,000. So it is up there. So,
Senator Weber.
Well, very good. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just curious because, like I said, I recently visited with two people who have dealt with different companies and were able to use each of those companies. Both filing their federal and their state, and actually they were located. They went to IRS to find out any type of free systems, and those were there. And so I was just curious as to why we thought we needed the report in light of the fact that there are services available. That was my main thrust of the question.
Thank you. Senator Rest.
I would just like to point out that the free filing is not really free at all. The states pay for it for the very reasons that at the federal level that Representative Joachim put forward. Much less chance of error. The information is entered correctly through these systems. The tax owed is more accurate, and the refunds can be delivered much more quickly through electronic means. So the federal government doesn't allow free filing out of the goodness of their hearts. There's always a cost. It's just who's paying. And I just think we should recognize that the federal system is not free except to the taxpayer. It costs and states pay for it because the benefits way outweigh going through audits, correcting mistakes, sending notices back to taxpayers, et cetera. It the benefits very much outweigh the price per return that are filed of the federal files, and it's a good system, quite frankly.
Chair Joachim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a few more things. I want to thank Senator Rest for mentioning the audits, too. Texts can be complicated. My husband's a math teacher and always took pride in doing his by paper and pen. And we kept getting audited. And part of it was he did not realize when he was, even though we qualified for a property tax refund, he wasn't adding back in his pension numbers. So there are always little things, and we get audited 3 years later. That costs the state money. This really cuts down on that, cuts down, like I said, on people being able to file false returns and with people with data that's out there. And also to put into perspective, you know, it may sound like a lot when you say $70,000, but I just want to put a name to those people that are out there that are in that income range. We're talking about for two first-time teachers together filing their tax returns. Or we're talking about a nurse and somebody who works a $15 an hour job. These are folks that do need a little help. They may have a first-time mortgage. They may have kids in daycare. They may have school loans to pay back. You know, this is a good investment to try to figure out, one, how to do all the things we've talked about, cut down on audits, save taxpayer security issues, but also just to provide a service. We are asking folks to pay their taxes. We want to provide a service. I know in the Senate bill, there's a provision that we hadn't heard about, a private letter ruling. Those are for folks that make a lot more money, and we're paying a lot more money to do that for the Department of Revenue, or talk about doing that for the Department of Revenue. So I just wanted to put that in perspective a bit about the folks that are out there that would utilize this service, that could use that help, and how I think it would really cut down on costs at the Department of Revenue as well.
Any other thoughts? Good discussion. All right, if not, we're going to move to the fifth and final thing on the agenda today, the tax expenditure review article. And there's primarily two main parts that I'll have Mr. Williams talk about. And one was a bill that Representative Abaje authored that would put purpose statements on bills. And then, so I'll have you talk about that first, and then we'll move to the second part. So Mr. Williams.
Chair Marquardt and members, so this provision that Representative Marquardt mentioned related to purpose statements is on page 41 of the side-by-side. It's in House Article 12, Sections 9 through 15. So Minnesota Statute Section 3.12 requires bills that are proposing new tax expenditures or proposing to continue existing tax expenditures to include a statement of purpose and goals against which the effectiveness of the tax expenditure must be measured. So sections 9 through 15 of the House bill include purpose statements for the current House omnibus tax bill. And Representative Abaje introduced a bill that additionally included purpose statements for previous omnibus tax bills that were enacted, but did not include purpose statements. If you look through the text of the legislation, these sections start on page 212. Of the House bill, and you'll see sort of the source or the House bills from which these purpose statements were drawn, and they sort of connect back to provisions in the enacted omnibus tax bills. But the actual enacting legislation for the omnibus tax bill did not include these purpose statements. So the House bill includes purpose statements for the 2019 tax bill, the 2017 tax bill, the 2017 tax conformity bill, the 2016 omnibus supplemental spending bill, which included some tax provisions, the 2014 omnibus tax bill, and all of those bills were enacted into law after the establishment of this requirement related to purpose statements, but without any purpose statements included.
Thank you, Mr. Williams. So it's another effort to create more transparency and accountability to taxpayers is the primary purpose of that. Any thoughts on that part before we move to the commission? All right, Mr. Williams, talk about the Tax Expenditure Review Commission.
Chair Marquardt and members, the Tax Expenditure Review Commission appears on page 39 of the side-by-side, and it's House Article 12, Sections 1 to 8, and then Section 16. I sort of would say that there's three main components to this proposal, so I'll sort of talk about them in turn. The first one is a modification to that requirement in Section 3.192 of Minnesota statutes, which requires the bill would require new bills that establish a tax expenditure or to sunset after 8 years. And this would apply to new tax expenditures and then also continuation of existing tax expenditures. The second part is some changes to Department of Revenue reports. So there's a little bit of changing of the schedules of the Department of Revenue reports so that the tax incident study would be moved to appear in March of each even numbered year. And then the tax expenditure study would be moved to appear in November of each even numbered year. There's also some new requirements added to the existing tax expenditure report. So the tax expenditure report would have to additionally include the purpose statements for tax expenditures to the extent that they've been identified. It would also have to identify the incidence of tax expenditures. And that sort of incidence analysis is limited to what the bill calls significant tax expenditures, which are tax expenditures that cross a particular revenue effects threshold and excluding certain business tax expenditures for which there may not be data available. The third thing is that the tax expenditure report would have to include the revenue neutral amount by which the tax to which the tax expenditure is related, the revenue neutral amount by which that tax could be reduced if the tax expenditure were repealed. The last and sort of most, I guess, the largest section of this article is the establishment of a tax expenditure review commission. So I'm not going to go section by section or subdivision by subdivision through this, but it's essentially a 9-member commission made up of legislators and the commissioner of revenue. It would be under the authority of the legislative coordinating commissions. The commission is tasked with evaluating tax expenditures on a rotating basis. The idea is that every tax expenditure would be reviewed by the commission at least once every 10 years. The commission would be required to hold hearings on each of these tax expenditures or on the tax expenditures being reviewed in the year. And then there would be an annual report sort of reporting the commission's findings. In terms of what the commission's review would include, I sort of direct you to page 204 of the House bill, and it spills on to page 205. And this is a subdivision titled Components of Review. So it says sort of at a minimum that the review must include sort of a list of items. Unless there's interest on the part of the conference committee, I'm probably going to hold off on reading through those out loud. So maybe I'll pause there and ask for a question.
So, thank you very much, Mr. Williams. And so, we know with the latest tax expenditure report that there's over $15 billion of tax expenditures. That's a pretty hefty sum. And so what the Tax Expenditure Review Commission would do is set up a process to bring these tax expenditures into the budget process. So there'd be kind of an ongoing look at these. And this is nothing new. In fact, Senator Bach, it was his bill, I think, in 2010 that authorized to look at this, to take a look at tax expenditures and setting up a review commission. I think that report came out in 2011. And I know Senator Bach is also the author on this. And there's a lot that mirrors what was in that report in 2011. But I just think now is the time to really start taking a look at this. I mean, again, a transparency and more accountability to taxpayers. These tax expenditures end up getting put into the tax code, and basically you never look at them again for the most part. A lot of times, there's no line in the budget. There's no kind of regular review process for them. A lot of them work on autopilot as they continue to grow. And so, Senator Bach had a lot to do with not only authoring the bill this year, but what's in the bill, having his report that he authorized had a lot to do with this. I don't know, Senator Bach, did you want to comment?
Well, Mr. Chairman, you're right. These tax expenditures receive no kind of scrutiny like other budget provisions do. And it just seems like having a periodic review of if they're meeting their intended purpose or where they don't have a purpose, create one. would be important to look at. And, you know, I've watched over the years as more and more people come to the tax committee to try to get a provision and essentially save themselves some money one way or another, because they know if they get it done there, they'll never have to come back. They'll have the permanent savings, unlike going after an appropriation where every 2 years you got to come back and compete for the money. So I think it bears looking at. And we've been talking about it for almost as long as I've been here and been unable to ever pull the trigger. And I think, frankly, the reason we haven't pulled the trigger is it's a lot of hard work.
Yeah.
And I know if members just haven't had the gumption, I guess, to actually try and take it on. And I don't know if the bill language is perfect, but there was a pretty extensive study done to try to figure out if we were going to do it, what would it look like? And this is the result of it. So if people have ideas how they could improve upon it, I tell you, I'd be all ears, but I just think they need some scrutiny.
Thank you, Senator Bach, and I agree with that. I mean, if it needs a little more work, certainly can do that. The cost, the Legislative Budget Office would staff most of it with some advisory role from the Department of Revenue. The cost is about, as it goes in, about $950,000 a year. So I see Commissioner Doty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to offer the fact that the department is very supportive of the goals of this provision. I think Senator Bach put it very nicely in terms of what's needed. And so we're very supportive of that and absolutely think that this could provide some very useful information for not only policymakers, but also the public as well. But agree that it is a lot of work, but we're committed to being as helpful and participate as much as we can on that. So I just want to say that. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Chair Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank you and Senator Bach for bringing this bill forward. I think it is a great idea for transparency. That tax expenditure for it is pretty hefty to look through, and we really do need to start looking at how we're spending our cash on expenditures when, as Senator Bach said, folks, when they come for appropriations, get a lot more scrutiny than those expenditures that just sit on the books. And thanks to Representative Agbaje for bringing forward the purpose statements as well. I think it's a very good idea to be explaining for future legislators what we were thinking of when we put certain things in mind. I've talked to friends that have businesses, and just for an example, rave about the angel investor credit that helped them make decisions and get their business off the ground, but then say, oh, but the research and development credit, we just assume we're going to get it. Doesn't really drive any decisions. So things like that we need to be looking at and how we're spending our state resources. So thank you.
Thank you. Chair Nelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I love the transparency discussion. I think that's always critically important for any government, particularly in the area of taxation. So I really like that. And I've been quite interested in the tax expenditures myself, especially that could be helpful in the future. Should we, you know, heaven forbid, we don't want to get into a position where we have a budget deficit, but some of us have lived through that time where we had a $6 billion budget deficit. Those are very difficult decisions. We would hope we will be going down that route, but I can understand why this would provide important information. I just have a couple of brief comments to consider as we further consider this piece. To say that these tax expenditures, once they're in the budget, they never get looked at again, well, that would be kind of like something that's in the base budget of our budget. I kind of see that coming from a finance chair and an appropriations committee. There are many things that are just in the base budget. And it kind of almost sounds like tax expenditures are kind of treated in the same way. And they do bear, and they should have great study into how they're working. Are they achieving the purpose are they worth the money? You know, is it worth what we're putting into those? So while I like that, I am concerned though about what appears to be a cost and what appears to be starting. Maybe I misunderstood. Is there a new? And well, this is what the revenue estimate looked like in the Senate. It called for 9 new full-time employees. Now, maybe the House one did not, but that's what it looked like in the Senate. And so I am cautious also when we are expanding employees, new full-time employees. And, you know, is this something that can be done in another way? Is there anything preventing us from doing it now? And so those are just further questions as we move forward with this issue. And maybe Commissioner Doty, Mr. Chair, could speak a little bit about, and now I'm speaking from memory, but it seems to be that the revenue estimate included payment for 9 full-time employees. But perhaps I'm wrong on that, and if the commissioner has it at hand, perhaps he can update me on that, or we can look at one of our researchers.
Yeah, thank you, Senator Nelson. I think if I'm remembering right, and we do have it, I thought it was 6.0 for the Legislative Budget Office and 1.2 for the Department of Revenue, which was a total of 7.2, but maybe Commissioner Doty has more specific, or even Ms. Schill maybe could. Let's go to Ms. Schill on this, because she is the one who puts all that great information together. So, Ms. Schill, what is the FTEs on this increase?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and Chair Nelson. The answer to your question is you are correct, Chair Marquardt, that the fiscal note that we included in the packet of materials for today's meeting identifies an additional 6 employees for the legislature that would be through the Legislative Budget Office, and then another 1.2 FTEs through the Department of Revenue. And that figure is located on the very first page of that 18-page component estimate. And then the detail follows on pages 3 and 4 and maybe into page 5.
Thank you very much, Ms. Schill. And I will say, Senator Nelson, that, you know, we're talking probably over 300 tax expenditures and like $15.5 billion. And if that's 7.2 employees, that's only one employee for overseeing over $2 billion of tax expenditures. So it, you know, probably in my mind would be money well spent, but at any rate, it's about $2 billion per employee to oversee and see if we can get a better handle on things. Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Good comparison. And I'll just ask, no, I won't ask any further questions at that time. That's sufficient for the moment.
All right. Sounds good. Anything else, members, on the tax expenditure article? Thank you all for the comments there. So, members, we've completed the agenda. We've covered kind of 5 more kind of items that I think kind of lays the foundation. So when we get the targets, the global agreement is reached, we've kind of dealt and talked with a lot of these. And, you know, I know our time's going to be diverted to the big money items. So I think the more of these we can talk about, the better it is. And it allows us to kind of get to these, and we know we've talked about them, and we can spend more time on some of the bigger items. So with that, Chair Nelson, I'm going to turn it over to you for some closing comments for the day.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Yes, you know, the ability to have this this forum to discuss the Senate bills, the House bill, where they're alike, where they're different, and also delving further into these issues, I think is important. And that is, we will continue that kind of a similar type organization tomorrow. You can look for the agenda later, but we'll be looking at, we'll be meeting at 1 o'clock, provided that we're not on our Senate floor or you're in the House floor. We might have to be flexible again. But we will be meeting, planning to meet tomorrow at 1, and we'll look at 4 or 5 issues where we may be looking at the same issue, but from different vantage points or different avenues. And we'll also look at some issues that are in one body and not the other. So we'll look at about 4 or 5 issues tomorrow. Again, I do appreciate the approach, Mr. Chair, I'm just looking at how can we be ready? I think we're all waiting with bated breath for Speaker Hortman and Majority Leader Gazelka and Governor Walz to get those global budget targets and then get one number to us in the tax committee that we'll be working with. And I also do want to note the importance of the, as we started this hearing, with the most recent report from the federal government regarding how can we use these massive resources coming to us from the federal government in our state. And as we look at, you know, the April 8th decision and now this decision, it does look like they're moving much closer to being specifically saying it doesn't appear that there's anything that says we cannot use these resources for conformity, like the clawback has now been removed. But typically, I understand these have to be specifically authorized uses. And so we hope that we can see that going forward and soon. Because as I said, tax conformity is always a large ticket item, particularly this year, more so than ever. And there's great uniformity in, I believe, most Minnesotans realizing we should not be taxing those lifelines that came to us from the federal government, and it is going to require a conformity decision, an active conformity action from us looking at those things. So we think hopefully in the next few days, we'll get greater clarity from our own leaders in looking at how we can use that most recent tax conformity update from the federal government. So I would just say to everyone, stay tuned. We have more discussions at hand here in the Tax Conference Committee. We also are waiting for those further decisions from those from our three leaders as far as that the final budget target. So with that, Mr. Chair, people can look for the agenda for the 1 o'clock hearing tomorrow.
Senator Nelson, those comments are well taken, and I appreciate that. And I do know, even though those interim final rule by the Treasury Department is, you know, over 100 pages, we only have 7 days left until the end of session. So I do hope we can get clarity as soon as possible on the big question on, you know, can we use these federal funding for sure, you know, on conformity and so forth. So big question to be asked, and I agree. I hope we'll here tonight or something that we've reached global agreement, and then we can really get going on the big items too. So
thank you.
Members, thank you for your work today. Staff, thank you for your work. And with that, we are adjourned.